Thank you.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
David Lloyd. I'm professor of English at the University of California, Riverside. I'm an Irish scholar who's been resident in the United States, teaching in the United States for the past 40 years or so. But I still continue to be very engaged with Irish culture, politics, literature. And currently, in some ways, as an offshoot of my interest in Ireland's history of being colonized and being in some degrees a settler colony, I've been particularly preoccupied since October the 7th with Israel's assault on Gaza, organizing around that. I have participation in a radio show called Swana Region Radio on Pacifica Radio KPFK in Los Angeles, and we have been doing a lot of interviews with Palestinians about what's happening there. So I share some affinity with you, Toby, as a veteran of the podcast and broadcast world.
Well, it's great to have you here, David, and you've, in a sense, already answered my initial question about what is currently preoccupying you. Some of those current preoccupations are long-term ones. In fact, they all are, by the sound of things, in terms of both recent, fairly recent colonialism and very ancient colonialism. And I wonder if you could draw for us then some parallels with further deftness or depth between the Irish experience and the Palestinian.
I would say I'd want to do that to pick up on your own terms there in relation to one of the older colonialisms in the world and that long history of English settlement of Ireland very deliberately to pacify Irish resistance starting in the 17th century, really, if one doesn't include the Norman conquest in the 12th century. So we've had a long experience of dispossession, settlement, and in my view, an effectively genocidal famine in the 19th century that people are probably familiar with that was commemorated about, gosh, it's already 30 years ago in 1995 and following, but which was often considered to be, an accident of the political economy of the time, that the British did not have a very good response to that famine, that 1 million people died out of a population of 8 million, and so forth. But in the course of that commemoration, it became very apparent that British response to the famine in Ireland was singular in Europe, where there were similar collapses of the potato crop that caused that famine in Ireland, and which were dealt with by different states in much more solicitous ways in terms of their population. And that the famine became an excuse for the clearance of the Irish population, either by death or migration. So we've had a long history of settler colonialism and all the things that go along with settler colonialism, including the clearance of populations, their dispossession, their dispersal, either globally, as in case of many Irish people, including myself, actually, and also the dispersal to the marginal regions of the country. More recently, I've been arguing that the Northern Irish entity, which was established after Ireland's war of decolonization or war of independence, however you want to phrase it, in the 1920s, actually consolidated settler colonial practices and mentalities in Northern Ireland, which persist to this day in the form of the kind of irredentist loyalists who form the majority party of Protestant or loyalist representation in Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party. And that those attitudes were really put in place by the establishment of a supremacist Protestant government for a Protestant people, as one Northern Irish Prime Minister famously put it. And that plays itself out in the to outside observers, astonishing phenomenon that all in Republican districts of Northern Ireland, you will see Palestinian flags everywhere, which perhaps is less astonishing because of the close relationship between the IRA and the Republican movement and the PLO back in the day. But that the unionist areas of Belfast, for example, are instantly recognizable by the fact that the pubs hang out the Star of David, the Israeli flag, outside in the form of bunting usually, and that it has been embraced by loyalists as a comparable situation. So in the work that I've done over the years, I've been trying to kind of participate with other post-colonial scholars in Ireland. It may come as a surprise to some of your listeners that post-colonialism was much castigated by the Irish establishment, rejected, repudiated, and indeed even reviled as, Republican fellow traveling. But, there has become now a significant body of work on the history of Irish colonialism and its impact on the culture. But that leads. And I think this explains why Ireland is among a very few European nations that has taken quite a strong line on condemning Israel's current assault on Gaza and has historically, over the past decades, been one of the most critical of the European Union nations of Israeli practice of the importation into Europe of settlement-produced goods and things like that. It is because there is a resonance, I think, for Irish people that some would dismiss as a kind of mythical, fantastical relation to the Palestinians, but which I think is part of a long tradition of Irish Republican solidarity with other anti-colonial movements. So it makes a lot of sense that it would be the Irish government under some duress, I suppose, from its own population, which is a good thing to see, was willing to actually call for a ceasefire out of the White House this St. Patrick's Day. And I think it explains why the Irish population has been, by and large, highly sympathetic to the Palestinian cause recently and over the years. So there's a kind of logic to the shift from a purely academic perspective to one which has, brought me to certain kinds of activism on behalf of Palestine.
Those of us outside the United States, Prof, are hearing a fair bit about campus activism there, re the invasion of Gaza, the occupation of Gaza, the bombing of Gaza, whichever terms of art, as it were, we should use. And one of the things that strikes some of us is that we have seen a faux pas by or the people who were the masters of the discourse of cancel culture, who now it seems are not so much in favor of free speech and are very keen on canceling people who say the wrong thing. You're nodding your head. Does that mean I got that bit right?
I would say, Toby, that you got that absolutely right. I mean, it's quite extraordinary the degree to which that which was repudiated as an index of tenured radicalism and its malevolent influence on a student body that we're accused of indoctrinating is the term they like to use, woke indoctrination, are now being faced with considerable efforts to cancel not only speech about Zionism, which with an extraordinary degree of stupidity is confused with critiques of Zionism, which is a political ideology, not a people and not a race. And the political ideology than in the United States is more represented by Christians than by Jews. I mean, when you think about it, the greatest support for Zionism comes from right-wing Christian evangelicals who, as Netanyahu must well know, despite the fact that he embraces them, is actually profoundly anti-Semitic in its implications because the Jews are meant to return to Israel in order to be incinerated in the final rapture at the end of times. But that seems not to bother Israeli Zionists that much because they get the support, the political support that they need. But certainly, cancel culture has become now the prerogative of the right, whether one thinks about the banning of certain African American texts in Florida, or whether one thinks about the extraordinary efforts that have been made to silence Students for Justice in Palestine, primarily, I would say, on private institutions' campuses, because, of course, we in a public university like the University of California are protected by the First Amendment. But it's important to recognize that, as I recently learned in a forum that we held at Riverside, from a representative of Palestine Legal, which is an important legal organization that defends the victims of attacks by Zionist forces in the United States. She pointed out that actually on private university campuses, we're not protected by the First Amendment, which only controls government restrictions on freedom of speech. So that was actually an important cautionary tale, and it explains why it's at places like Columbia that they can get away with banning Students for Justice in Palestine, or expel, threatening to expel students for speech about Palestine and so forth. But this phenomenon of the desire to cancel has taken an interesting path in its evolution. I remember when we founded the US campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel in 2009, we would bring Palestinian speakers like Omar Barghouti, one of the founding members of the Palestine Boycott National Committee, BDS National Committee, who, are extremely eloquent advocates of Palestinian rights, but we could get Zionists to debate him in public. Within a few months almost, we found it almost impossible to get anybody to debate him because the facts are not really on Israel's side, and they were losing the public ear, so to speak. And so they turned to lawfare. And you may recall, for example, that the American Studies Association passed a boycott resolution in 2013, December 2013, much to a chorus of repudiation and rejection by the mass media and of course, by Zionist organizations. And the response to that, however, was not to debate, but to commit what they call lawfare, it's their term, bringing suits against the organization and so forth. And that has become increasingly the practice, not to take on in public a debate about the facts to do with Israel and the facts to do with its settler colonial nature or its apartheid nature and so forth, but rather to try to suppress speech. And the usual means of doing so is to invoke the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, usually known in short as the IHRA definition, which most of whose examples are actually not examples of anti-Semitism in the normal definition of that, but examples of criticism of Israel. So we are now faced with the invocation of that, and in certain cases, its passage into state law as the proper definition of anti-Semitism, and therefore its correlation with hate speech law and so forth. So yeah. Cancel culture has now become the province of the right in a very peculiar way, even as they lecture us always about having to open up the university to multiple points of view.
Yes, and I've always been interested in opening up business schools and economics and psychology faculties to different points of view. I well remember at University of California, Riverside, when I was there, David,
I remember well.
a request from the economics department across the University of California system that its salaries be set on a scale that was different from the rest of the university, because essentially they were liable to be offered huge increases to work for banks and other financial institutions, and this was duly passed. When the financial crisis of 2008 hit, I suggested that this should mean not that they would, in fact, see their salaries drop, but that they would lose tenure and be dismissed from the university. If that was the case, that there should be some structural homology, some correlate between the conditions of so-called economists at financial institutions and in universities. You'll be astonished to learn, Prof, that I was a voice in the wilderness.
Yes, I'm shocked that they were not fired en masse as they should have been. I mean, there was a wonderful documentary in which a number of economists were interviewed who were directly responsible for the policies that were introduced into countries like Iceland, for example, and
Right.
who passed these reports through leading up to the crisis on the extraordinary health and vitality of the Icelandic banking system, for example. That was a Columbia economist whose name perhaps, it will protect your podcast from suit that I have forgotten.
Ah, yes, the value of forgetting. Now, Prof, you'll excuse me, I'm, as well, listeners, I'm just putting on the inevitable cup of tea.
Very good.
Because it's that time of day here. Now, moving on from that, I wondered if we could get back to Ireland. And in
I've
particular,
been wondering that too, if I could ever get back.
well, my friend Bill Grantham left LA and moved back to Ireland after as long away as you'd been. And he's living in Tinnehealy and having a great old time.
Good. Well, I'll be going back this summer. But anyway,
That's
that's
not
not what
neither
you're
here nor
about to
there.
ask, I'm
I
sure.
wanted to ask you about Ireland and France's most famous cricketer,
Ah, Samuel
Sandy
Beckett.
Beckett,
Yes.
about whom you have written much, a notable, fairly recent book, I think. Could you take us down the Becketing path, the Beckett path? He must be one of the most written about writers, dramatists, cricketers in the history of the world, I think. I mean, Joyce would be one in the English language, and Beckett, not only in English, would be just about number two after, I guess, Shakespeare, at the top, right?
Well, that was my unhappy discovery as I began to work on Beckett, was that it would be impossible, I suspect, for any scholar to consume all the material that has appeared on Beckett. And it's all the more remarkable in that he has only been dead for 40, 45 years now. And that the outpouring of work about his own work began almost as soon as Waiting for Godot closed its curtains on its last night in Paris in whatever it was, 1950. So it really is an extraordinary phenomenon, merited, I would say, of course, by the extraordinary ways in which he transformed every genre in which he worked, with the possible exception of poetry. I mean, theater, novel, the short story. Even indeed, and this was partly what I wrote about, his singular take on painting at the time,
It's in the
when he
title, I
was,
think, or subtitle.
it, yes, so yeah, the book I wrote is called Beckett's Thing, Painting and Theatre. And what I was interested in is what he was actually seeing in painters' work, because a lot had been written when I started my research on this, about the kind of aesthetic statements that he made in a series of writings about painting that he composed mostly in France about painters that he knew there in the 1940s and very early 50s. So it was quite a brief period in which he was writing about painting, but they've always been taken along with an essay that he wrote about Proust and an essay that he wrote about James Joyce as a kind of ars poetica or an aesthetic statement on his part. And so, they've been taken as if they were really about literature, and not much was done to think about what he was seeing in these paintings. And that's what I devoted the book to try to reconstruct what it was that he might have been seeing and how that might have impacted his theater as a highly visual. I mean, it's one of the most visual theatrical oeuvres that one can imagine. Every play produces a kind of visual image, whether it's Godot's tree or whether it's Endgame with that kind of skull-like interior and a man sitting in a wheelchair in the middle of it and the parents in the dustbin. Or even if you go further and the extraordinary late play that's about torture, What Wear, which when it was done for German TV, they just created these silhouette-like faces on the screen. I mean, I don't know what German TV watchers thought when they first saw this appear. But that capacity to see, so that if you're looking at one of the visual recordings of a Beckett production, you can stop it almost anywhere and see a painting. I mean, his sense of visuality was quite extraordinary. But the other thing was that he was very interested in the gradual emergence of a non-representational painting that was not abstract art. He moves through a painter who became an abstract painter, Bram van Velde, from Jack B. Yeats, an Irish painter that he was very close to, an older man when Beckett was young, but they became very, very close friends, who himself moves from a highly representational nationalist kind of art to a extreme expressionist art, where sometimes you can hardly make out the image and the vigor of the impasto with which he applies the paint. Then he ends up with, interestingly, a Jewish Israeli artist who survived the labor camps in Romania and was snuck out, or snuck out, he was rescued by the Red Cross as a teenager, who began his artistic life in Paris as an abstract painter, and then suddenly turned back to what he calls depiction rather than representation. I argue that what Beckett develops in his relation to these painters is a way of writing about and thinking about the thing as opposed to the object, because representation always has an object. A subject represents something to themselves in the form of an object. But Beckett was always very interested, starting with his writings on Jack B. Yeats, in humans and things that escaped representation as objects, that escaped the capacity of the subject to possess them. And his major writing on the Dutch painter, Bram van Velde, the subject of the three dialogues with Georges Dutuy, which has become a kind of standard text on, Beckett expressing his aesthetic. But it's all about dispossession. It's all about relinquishing the desire to possess the world. And that seemed to me, as I worked more on it, to be Beckett's whole project was to try to think the human after humanism had been largely, made disreputable by European civilization's wars, the Holocaust, all of this. And he has this terse remark in one of his essays on Bram van Velde, which has been resonating in my head over the last months. And he just says, "Humanity, a vocable much invoked in times of great massacres." And that sense that one had to get past that humanist idea of civilization as an apparatus of possessing the world seemed to me very much the project. And that final play, the last play that he ever wrote, What Wear, is all about torture. It's about a voice that commands others to give somebody the works, and they each get given the works in turn. And it made me realize, of course, that Beckett has to be understood in the context of the century of torture. He was a young man in 1930s, 1920, late 1920s and 1930s Ireland, hanging out with Republicans who had been imprisoned first by the British and then by the new Irish state, and subjected to torture on a routine basis. Many of whom, I'm thinking particularly of a man called Ernie O'Malley, wrote brilliantly about what it was to be imprisoned. And actually, I have my father's British edition, the London edition of Ernie O'Malley's On Another Man's Wound, his memoir of the Irish War of Independence when he was an IRA organizer. And the 6 pages about his being tortured in Dublin Castle when he was arrested are omitted with a series of asterisks in the English edition, because it was not yet acceptable to talk about it in the 1930s. But anyway, Beckett knew these people. Then, of course, in the war, he was involved in the French Resistance, along with a number of Jewish friends that he had been hanging out with in Paris in the context of the journal Transition. And they created a cell for which he was the scribe, really. He translated and communicated the messages back to London. And that group was betrayed, and he had to flee to the south of France, where he famously spent the war. But it struck me that, of course, nobody who's involved in the French resistance would not begin by asking themselves whether they could survive torture. I mean, it would just have been one of the fundamental things that you discussed with your colleagues in that, in whatever resistance cell you belong to. If I am captured, how long will I survive? How long will I be able to keep my mouth closed in the face of the Gestapo's tortures? Then later, of course, he became involved with his publisher, Jérôme Linden, the editor of Édition de Minuit that published Beckett, who was the first to circulate among French intellectuals and artists a petition against torture during the Algeria War. And Beckett was unable to sign it because he wasn't a citizen. And of course, the French government was highly repressive of opposition to the Algerian war and was exporting, deporting people who challenged it. So he couldn't sign it, but he certainly circulated that petition. So if I'm thinking of Beckett's career, it constantly wraps itself around resistant movements and torture. And I think we find that more and more from the great, extraordinary, and much neglected novel, How It Is, through to this last play, What Wear. This idea of the human reduced to thingliness is Beckett's exploration of what a post-Kantian universe looks like. And if you think about it, during the torture debates that followed the exposure of what was happening in Bagram and Abu Ghraib and places like that, the discussion of torture ceased to be featured in terms of the Kantian prohibition on the use of the human subject as a means to an end, and therefore the absolute prohibition on torture as a violation of the autonomy of the human subject. And got to be discussed in terms that were basically, what would it feel like to me? Would it feel like torture? And so the redefinition by the White House lawyers of torture said that so long as it came short of a feeling like death, it was not torture. Or the Attorney General Mukasey was asked in a congressional hearing whether such and such, I think it was waterboarding, would feel like torture. And he said, well, it might feel like that to me. So suddenly, the whole Kantian notion of the autonomous subject who reflects ethically on the world from a rational perspective was being replaced by what Kant called a pathological subject, the subject who feels pain. And if you look at Beckett's work from even before Waiting for Godot on, what you get are these couples that change places, inflicting pain on one another, so that you get a kind of tortured couple. And it struck me that that was Beckett's paradigm of modern subjectivity, the end of the autonomous subject and its replacement by what my colleague Denise Ferreira da Silva has called the affectable subject. And it seems to me that Beckett was astonishingly prescient, and that much of his prescience came out of his understanding and awareness of anti-colonial struggle, in which people, of course, had, as Aimé Césaire famously put it in the Discourse on Colonialism, colonialism is a machine for the thingification of humans. So that's my sense of Beckett's really epochal significance as a writer, that he's capturing something about a transition in our understanding of what it is to be human that is quite monumental, but derives straight out of a generalization that I think Césaire captured, a generalization of the condition of the colonized as the condition of the neoliberal society. We can go
And
there if you want, but
well, you, I'd like to go back to your brief quotation from Beckett, which seems to suggest, or you seem to suggest, is about the confluence of inhumanity and liberal humanism.
yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that in the context of another of your books, Underrepresentation, which is a critique inter alia of liberalism. And I wondered if you could just take us on a little tour d'horizon
Well, let me first of all give the subtitle of that book, which will help to explain what it's about. Underrepresentation, which of course is a play about being underrepresented, but also about being under the thumb of representation, is subtitled on the aesthetic regime, sorry, on the racial regime of aesthetics. And if one is looking for discourse which offers the liberal subject a domain in which the liberal subject can realize its freedom, then that space is the space of aesthetic culture. And that goes back to Kant, and also, of course, to Friedrich Schiller, who interpreted Kant in his famous Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man. Why is that? Why is the aesthetic? So we are offered political freedom, but as Schiller recognized, politics always divides. It's of its nature to divide groups into subgroups and into oppositional ideologies and so forth. And we have to remember that both Kant's Third Critique of Judgment, which is his work on aesthetics, and Schiller's Aesthetic Letters were written under the influence of the French Revolution and the vision of upheaval, terror, and so forth that produced. And Schiller combines a sense of the dangers of the division of society by political ideologies with his sense of the human under an emerging capitalism as being divided in itself by the division of labor and by specialization and so forth. So, quite prescient, given that Germany was not a major capitalist country at that moment, as Marx points out. He was already theorizing the impact of the division of labor on the ways in which the human subject loses its capacity for a harmonious development of its faculties, as he puts it, and becomes singularized, divided, and unfulfilled. And so the aesthetic is then offered as the domain in which the autonomous subject can actually realize itself free of the divisions that afflict it in other spheres of its life, economic, political, social, religious, and whatever. And so it's always seemed to people as the domain of freedom. And in our very sick culture at the moment, the way in which that plays itself out is in the term creative. If you think of, the highly paid operatives in Google or in Apple are called the creatives, and the rest are, the sludge who do the drudge work. But the idea of the creative is still appealed to. And although poetry might be seen as a dead art, as is, theater and printmaking and so forth, I think there's probably never been a time in which there are so many poets. And I think that the idea of being a creative as an alibi for one's own reduction to a thing within the capitalist machine is an offshoot of this long belief that aesthetics. The domain of the aesthetic, of the creative, is the domain in which we find our freedom. And so, if one can claim to participate in that domain, one has a freedom to oppose against one's, instrumentalization. Along with that goes the idea, however, across both Kant and Schiller, that what the aesthetic produces in this sphere of disinterested creativity is an image of the human. And very quickly, a distinction is made, starting in Kant's Analytica of the Sublime, between a relation to the world, and Kant is thinking of nature, and Schiller begins the movement of thinking about it in terms of fine art. That movement entails a division of the human subject that is absolutely fundamental between the autonomous and what I've referred to already as the pathological. The pathological subject is the one who is under the influence of nature, so to speak, their own nature or nature as a force in the world. So, in other words, if we approach the artwork according to Kant for gratification, because it gives us pleasure, we approach the artwork as we might approach a bar of chocolate. You may love chocolate, I may hate chocolate. And we have a taste for chocolate, or we have a distaste for chocolate, but it's all about the pleasure that it gives us, the gratification that it gives us. Or we may approach a phenomenon in fear. This cliff before me with the sea beating on it terrifies me because I might fall over, and it's about my own survival. That's not an aesthetic relationship to a sublime image of the cliff. We are not free when we relate to the world, as Kant puts it, pathologically, in terms of things that drive us, whether it's our desires, our gratifications, our fears, or whatever. And so the aesthetic, as it's deduced from Kant through Schiller into Hegel and then on, even to famous modernist aesthetic theorists like Walter Benjamin and Theodor Adorno, retains this idea that there is a version of the human subject that is subordinated, unfree, and a version of the human subject that is free and able to develop further its freedom. And that reinscribes into the very heart of aesthetics a kind of developmental judgment of the human. There are humans who are subject to forces beyond their control, and there are humans who are autonomous. And we can track that into the distinction between the vulgar consumer of art, the popular cultural, its domain of art, and high art. We can track it forward even to the formation of the state, because as Schiller says, it's in the idea of the human that we get from the aesthetic that we have a foreshadowing of the perfect human state. If we think about it, one of the things that Israel is doing right now is engaging in a massive destruction of Palestinian cultural institutions. And the great West African Portuguese anti-colonial theorist Amilcar Cabral pointed out in the 1960s that it is one of the things that colonialism seeks most ardently to do, which is to destroy the culture of the native, because the fact that the native has culture means that they're human. And if you can call them people without culture, then you can call them people who are subhuman. Or in Israeli Defense Minister Gallant's words, human animals. And so that destruction of a colonized people's culture is absolutely core, because what it does is to kind of produce, performatively, as a fact, the absence of a culture by which you, in fact, judge a people inferior and in need of tutelage and in need of governance by others. So this, what looks like the space in which we find our freedom, becomes actually a regulative regime for discriminating between different forms of human. And I think that it's an extremely important way in which we see, I argued this with my friend Paul Thomas in a book called Culture and the State. We see the aesthetic become, in the form of cultural education, the absolute core of democratic education, starting with Matthew Arnold in Britain and moving through into the simple fact that English departments are usually the largest in every college of letters, arts, and sciences. There's a reason for that, which is because they were supposed to develop citizens. There's therefore a reason for their shrinking in the current age, which is that neoliberalism doesn't need critical citizenship. In fact, it's not interested in it at all. Which could take us on to a discussion of the current state of the university.
Ironically, of course, this means that institutionally what's happened is that there is a regression, what Kant called self-incurred immaturity, and
Yes.
enunciation of consumerism and religiosity, however subtly put. Prof, I wanted to ask you one more question and then throw to you so that you could add anything we haven't touched on. Yeah? And actually, my last question was about that terrific book, which was how I first encountered your work, getting on for 30 years ago. Probably was 30 years ago that you guys wrote it, Culture and State, the one you
Not
just mentioned.
quite, but close on. Yes, getting there.
Well,
25 years.
comes out in 97.
Yeah.
That looks to me like 27 years. You
27.
probably started writing it a couple of years before it was published. So
We did actually,
I'm getting all empirical on you here and
yeah.
putting it
I know, the dreaded
in around the
empiricism.
30-year mark. Well, may you take a deep sip of your water, sir, when I confront you in this way. But in all seriousness, it was a very many books that you have both edited and written have been important. This one happens to be very important to me, and I'd love to know if you could tell us a little bit about what you guys were up to. You've just mentioned that in the context of the legacy of aesthetics and how you view it now in 2024.
Well, what we were up to was, I think, very definitely trying to tease apart the liberal professoriate's investment in culture as a kind of alibi for the institution of the university. So we were writing, if you remember, across the cusp of the rolling back of affirmative action in the University of California system, and of course nationally in the United States. So, for brief history for those of your listeners who aren't from the US, the opening up of higher education to what are now called underrepresented minorities, that is, racialized people in the United States, was really initiated by Brown versus Board of Education, the famous legal case that decided that segregated education in the United States was not acceptable. It had been called separate but equal. Much as, Palestinians now living in Israel are subject to a regime where they have separate but unequal accommodation in where they live and so forth. But that opened the way to a desegregation of educational institutions, including higher education. It was consolidated, interestingly, by Republican President Richard Nixon in the form of affirmative action, which was not only about education, but impacted education particularly, where it was possible to say, in order for a more even representation of the various racial groups that are recognized in this country, to be achieved by universities, you can actually give preference to the admission of certain categories of people so long as they, fulfill certain basic standards. Affirmative action did lead to a diversification of the student body in very interesting ways that I experienced as a young professor at University of California, Berkeley, back in the 80s. And what struck me at the time was that what it was leading to was not simply a diversification, which the later rubric, which was designed to contain this impact called Excellence and Diversity, sought to contain and to, if you like, to pacify. What was happening under affirmative action was that affirmative action, first of all, brought in students who were still connected with social movements in their communities. It brought in students who, inevitably, if you were going to actually increase the numbers of students of color in the university working class. So they were not, already kind of acculturated to the protocols of the university, to certain forms of respect and so-called civility. And accordingly, they were changing the culture of the university, much to the chagrin of the liberal professoriate. And I really remember that as coming up in these debates we were having about instituting an American cultures requirement, which was really, a requirement that students consider the impact of race in American history and culture. And so when Paul and I, Paul was a political scientist, I was in literature, we were talking about, where this insistence on the acculturating and civilizing effect of education was coming from. And I, having spent a lot of time, in my PhD reading romantic literature, and so I just assumed that what had happened was that a culture that espoused representativity in the way that romantic artists did, that the poet is representative of the human, was embraced ultimately by working class movements in the form of their democratization. And we wanted to really track that and see where this idea that education and culture, including, I must say, things like the American cultures requirement that we instituted at Berkeley, where these came from, where this idea that you could develop critical citizenship came from. To our great surprise, I think we discovered that actually, rather than working class people reading these great romantic authors like Coleridge or Wordsworth and learning, the virtues of representation, we found actually that up till the end of the 1840s, they were rejecting representation as a category. They didn't want to be represented by another. They saw it as a governmental plot. They saw state-driven education as a way in which the government would pacify them. And it was only with the 1848 failure of the 1848 revolutions, the slightly earlier collapse of British Chartism, which was the major labor movement of the time, that they began to move towards the coeval demands for franchise and for education. And so we were able to track the emergence of an ideology of education as inculcating the virtues of representation through the 19th century, and to see that as the core message, if you like, of cultural education, that one should be represented and that one should be representable and that one should see the world in terms of representation. This is, I must say, Rancière had not written the works that have now become famous at the time, Jacques Rancière, the French aesthetic theorist. It's where I see him as actually being mistaken, because he talks about the regime of representation ending with the end of the 18th century, and then he has what he calls the aesthetic regime. In my view, in both these books that we're discussing, Culture in the State and Underrepresentation, it's quite clear that the aesthetic regime is a regime of representation and a regime in which representation becomes a kind of developmental narrative. When we wrote Culture in the State, we were actually really interested in why it was that liberal professors were so disturbed by affirmative action, so unsettled by having to deal with students who challenged their transparency, to use the term that Denise Da Silva, who I've already remarked on, uses, the transparent subject. The idea of the professor, of course, was that they were representative. The idea of the professor was that they were representative of the human, and as such, representative, therefore, of the truth, and that they stood in the place of truth. When they're challenged in their bodies, that's extremely disturbing for the very formation that they have embraced and what forms their existence as subjects. And I think that in its sort of, further implications, Culture in the State was really about a genealogy of that position of the teacher that was coming under fire at the time that we were writing and was producing extremely emotive reactions. So yes, it's a very scholarly book that reads a lot of old newspapers and things like that, but it was written out of that situation in order to understand the possibilities that had emerged in that situation.
Well, Prof, we've got about 3 minutes left until I have my next guest on deck, as they say in baseball.
Ha, very good.
So,
I
with
see you got the water behind you. I hope you're not going to throw us off the deck into the water.
that. With that 3 minute warning, Prof, are there things you'd like to add to what we've discussed? Areas that we touched on where you want to offer something more, or things we haven't mentioned that you want to describe?
Well, there's one thing I do want to remark in on, which is relevant to the general field of cultural studies and its relation to what was always historically called theory, and they always had an uneasy relation. But cultural studies is also a theoretical practice, and one thing that as I approach the end of my academic career, that I would want to remark on, is that it proves extremely difficult still, despite all the critiques coming from post-colonial and race-critical perspectives and so forth, for work that is situated in what the metropole likes to think of as its margins, whether we're talking about work emerging from a place like Ireland, which is where I've done most of my work from, or work that's emerging from Palestine now, or work that's emerging from the Philippines, say. For them to be seen as sites of critical theorization that transform our understanding of modernity, So when I write a book that is about Kant and Schiller and Marx and Adorno and Benjamin, I'm intrigued by the fact that it gets a whole lot of attention for its arguments from people in mainstream scholarship. Whereas when I write a book that is situated in Irish culture and colonialism, making very, very similar arguments, perhaps more forcefully, that never circulates outside the context of Irish studies. Now, I don't mean that as a complaint, but rather as an observation on how difficult it has proven for us to actually work out the implications of a critique from the global south of modernity. And I know there are numerous practitioners who are trying to transform our understanding of contemporary modernity and of its genealogies from precisely those kinds of locations. But the difficulty of getting either theory or cultural studies actually to see the transformative nature of material of analysis coming from its so-called margins, the ways in which the world looks differently. We're beginning to see finally, actually, the outcomes of that, I think, in South Africa's legal case against Israel for genocide. But suddenly, we're actually seeing an institutional way in which the experience of the global South, the experience of colonization, is beginning to totally recalibrate how the world is getting understood. And I think that's an interesting conjunction, and I'm really interested to see how that's going to play out, what it would mean for the world to be re-envisaged, not from the theoretical perspective of, say, the modernist theorists that I mentioned, like Adorno and Benjamin or Derrida or whoever, but to actually see what happens when, if you like, indigenous theorizations from other spaces begin to become hegemonic and not merely an interesting footnote.
Indeed, where the South becomes not an object but a subject.
Indeed, one way to put, though I'm very suspicious of the subject-object vocabulary, as you get
One can be suspicious of these binaries, but suspicion doesn't necessarily do away with them. Thank you so
No,
much, David.
absolutely.
It's just been wonderful
It's a
chatting
pleasure
to
to
you.
see you and to catch up again. And yeah,
Lovely. Thank you.
hopefully we'll